I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Today is Tuesday, December the 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, at least 100 people are feared dead following a series of powerful tornadoes tearing through six American states over the weekend.
This is the worst storm to hit Kentucky in my lifetime.
Residents of the Ethiopian town of Lalibela, a UN World Heritage Site, say that Tigray rebels have captured the area from federal forces for a second time. And today we explore the question, are autocratic regimes better positioned to fight the COVID-19 pandemic?
If you have a government that is malicious and doesn't have good intentions, then you're going to see negative outcomes. And oftentimes that is indeed what we see, that these governments are self-serving, they're looking out for their own best interests, and they don't do what's best for their people.
And the chief prosecutor in Geneva says that he has closed a criminal investigation into allegations that Spain's former king Juan Carlos laundered illegal commission payments from Saudi Arabia. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, President Biden is pledging his administration will do whatever needed to help states ravaged by weekend tornadoes. AP's Washington correspondent Saga Megani reports.
President Biden will visit Kentucky Wednesday to see the devastation of last week's tornadoes. The president says the damage is stunning and the government's doing all it can to help, not just there, but in other affected states.
We're going to get this done. We're going to be there as long as it takes.
The White House says the president will aim to be a source of comfort for people on the ground. Top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell says he's grateful for the administration's efforts as his state reels.
This is the worst storm to hit Kentucky in my lifetime.
He says the state will unite to rebuild. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Moments after updating the number of dead in the devastating tornado outbreak, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear became emotional. AP's Rita Foley has more.
I'm not doing so well today. And I'm not sure how many of us are.
Governor Beshear shared a poignant moment.
I was working on getting the confirmed deaths this morning and realized I was writing on the back of notes that one of my kids took from school.
The notes, he said, were on inertia.
It means that an object that's in motion will stay in motion. So we're going to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And push through this.
And he made this promise to tornado victims.
We're going to be with you today. We're going to be with you tomorrow. And we're going to be there with you to rebuild.
I'm Rita Foley.
And President Biden signed an executive order aimed at easing bureaucratic frustration among Americans seeking a wide swath of federal services, from renewing passports to applying for Social Security benefits. AP's Washington correspondent Saga Megani joins us again with this report.
Americans waste a lot of time with office visits or long phone calls. The executive order is geared toward cutting paperwork and allowing them to access more services online. The White House hopes improving experiences with federal agencies will help renew faith in the government and democracy itself. The president last week urged the U.S. and other nations to show they can work for their people.
Democracy's hard. We all know that.
Similar attempts to make the government more nimble have failed for generations. Bill Clinton famously pledged to reinvent government nearly 30 years ago. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The House panel investigating the Capitol insurrection is set to recommend contempt charges against Donald Trump's former White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows. AP's Jennifer King reports.
The January 6th committee staff said they had a lot of unanswered questions about Mark Meadows' emails, including one saying that the National Guard would be present to, quote, protect pro-Trump people. There were emails to leadership at the Department of Justice encouraging investigations of suspected voter fraud. The committee says that in one text exchange, Meadows said that Trump believed Vice President Pence had the power to reject electors as he presided over the certification. On other texts, the day of the attack, Meadows' former House colleagues and even organizers at the rally encouraged him to get Trump to discourage the violence after things got out of hand.
President Biden convened the Summit for Democracy last week, calling the fight to protect democracy as the defining challenge of our time. His administration also released a list of initiatives designed to strengthen and encourage democracies abroad, including fighting corruption, strengthening of a free press, while supporting democratic reformers to defend free and fair elections in their countries. The summit came at a time when the U.S. is also experiencing its own challenges to its democracy. The fight to protect personal freedoms has been increasingly difficult, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Analysts warn that many regimes have used COVID-19 restrictions to expand their power and justify repression of their citizens. Professor Erica France teaches political science at Michigan State University. She has authored books and articles on authoritarian politics, democratization, conflict, and development. And she joins me for the second part of our conversation on how the pandemic has reshaped the conversation on social justice movements, with some autocratic regimes depriving protest movements of their ability to gather in public spaces. But first, I asked Professor Erica about the argument made that autocratic regimes are better positioned to fight the pandemic.
There are certainly benefits to authoritarianism in a variety of ways. If there's a financial crisis, an authoritarian government can react quicker. If there's a global pandemic, the authoritarian government can react quicker. So the same sort of gridlock that a democracy would encounter, authoritarian governments don't face. They have a lot of latitude to make changes happen, even if those changes are unpopular. The big risk, though, is you don't know what type of authoritarian government you're going to get. If you have a government that is malicious and doesn't have good intentions, then you're going to see negative outcomes. And oftentimes that is indeed what we see, that these governments are self-serving, they're looking out for their own best interests, and they don't do what's best for their people. Should they choose to act in ways that are caring and so forth, then they certainly have more freedoms to implement unpopular policies such as government lockdowns and so forth.
Which countries in this hemisphere, aside from the U.S., worry you the most in terms of how the erosion of democratic values in their countries carry a far greater symbolic weight and that it would be tough to reverse in case they end up as autocratic systems?
Well, you know, the U.S. is obviously a very troubling case because even though Trump left power, the quality of American democracy has not rebounded. But outside of the U.S., Brazil is also very troubling. The country has had decades of democratic rule following that military dictatorship. And the arrival of Bolsonaro has been very troubling because he has openly indicated undemocratic tendencies. He has a very loyal group of followers. He's restricted rights. He's had a terrible record of handling the pandemic. So it's possible that that's going to come back to bite him. But the upcoming Brazilian elections will very much be important in terms of what the future holds for democracy in Brazil. And that's the case in a lot of these backsliding democracies, that once they start backsliding, the really important moment is the next election. Do we see the incumbent reelected and more of the same? Is it seen as like a stamp of approval for what the incumbent has done? Or do we see some sort of pushback from ordinary people where they, you know, make it clear that that's not the direction they'd like their country to go in?
When we look at some of these countries that are reversing or declining in their democratic ideals, what are some of the institutions that these autocratic rulers or would-be autocratic rulers go to first or to destroy?
There are two that come to mind that are very valuable. The first is the judiciary. Ideally, in a democracy, you'd like to have some judicial independence where political decisions don't factor into judicial decisions. So if you see the judiciary being targeted, it likely is through hiring and firing of judges, trying to put your cronies into high-level judicial appointments. All of that is going to create a more biased judiciary, which then enables the leader to do further things that are harmful for democracy. Because once these cronies are in place, they don't face any checks to their rule. The other institution that's important, and this is kind of like the fourth branch of government, is the media. So this new wave of wannabe authoritarians often buys out the media or important and influential media organizations, or sideline the traditional media through the use of social media. And that can be very troubling because we do really rely on the media as a check on our leadership and as an information pathway for ordinary citizens to be able to evaluate their leaders.
Professor Erica Franz teaches political science at Michigan State University. The World Health Organization and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, a leading cancer center in the United States, are planning to provide cancer medication free of charge to children in developing countries suffering from this condition. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Cancer is a leading cause of death worldwide, killing about 10 million people a year. The World Health Organization estimates 400,000 children globally develop cancer every year, with nearly 100,000 dying. The most common types of childhood cancers include leukemias, brain cancers, lymphomas, and solid tumors. WHO reports nearly 9 in 10 children with cancer live in low- and middle-income countries. Andre Ilbawi heads WHO's cancer division in the Department of Non-Communicable Diseases. He says about 80% of children who have cancer in high-income countries survive. He calls this a major achievement and improvement over the past decades.
But that progress hasn't been achieved for children who are living in low- and middle-income countries, where 30% or less will survive a cancer diagnosis. One of the primary reasons is because of care that is simply not available or accessible, and medicines are a core part of the treatment of childhood cancer.
WHO and St. Jude's Hospital have formed a partnership to change this situation. They've established a platform that will dramatically increase access to childhood cancer medicines around the world. To kickstart this program, St. Jude is making a 6-year investment by contributing $200 million. Ilbawi says the money initially will provide medication at no cost to 12 countries that will take part in a 2-year pilot program. He says the governments will be involved in the care of the children and in selecting the medicines that are needed.
From there, we'll work with country partners to make sure those medicines are delivered safely and effectively to the children in need. Over time, this will increase to 50 countries or more within 6 years. This means that almost every child around the world, particularly those in low- and middle-income countries, will benefit from this platform.
The new platform aims to provide safe and effective cancer medicines to approximately 120,000 children between 2022 and 2027. The health partners say the program will be scaled up to include many more beneficiaries in future years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The impact of Lebanon's financial collapse has left thousands of people living in poverty, with many having to rely on local NGOs to provide their basic food needs. A UN report warns that many Lebanese are living in multidimensional poverty that includes lack of access to health, education, and basic food needs and public utilities. The report revealed that more than half of families in Lebanon had at least one child who skipped a meal amid a dramatic decline of living conditions in the country. Reporter George Eid has more from Beirut.
The Ministry of Social Affairs says that 25% of Lebanese suffer from extreme poverty, while 70% are struggling to make ends meet amid an economic and financial collapse. The ministry is currently assisting 36,000 families suffering from extreme poverty by giving them a $25 food cart and a further $15 for each family member. But for the rest of the Lebanese in need, it is the NGOs who have stepped in. Today in Beirut, hundreds of NGOs are trying to help people in need. Beit al-Baraka is an NGO based in Beirut. Its founder, May Ibrahim Shah, explains that since last year, the number of people in need has increased by more than twice the number.
We used to help 50,000 families across the Lebanese territory, and now we're helping 226,000 Lebanese families, which means we're very close to 1 million people. And those we help are selected from the most fragile segments of the society, being the elderly and children.
A recent World Bank report says that more families are falling under the poverty line in Lebanon. The report revealed that the Lebanese population under the international poverty line is estimated to have risen by 13% in 2020 alone and is expected to further increase by as much as 28% by the end of 2021, amounting to 1.5 million Lebanese. Jackie Touma, a Lebanese who resides in Beirut, says that she has been relying on NGOs for her basic food needs since the Beirut port explosion in August 2020. She says, the situation is really bad. I have been receiving food rations from NGOs in Beirut. They have been helping me. They provide me with food and clothing every month. I rely on them sometimes to pay my electricity and water bills. I have been jobless, and given my age, no one wants to hire me anymore. I'm really worried about the future. Rima Kouri, a university student, explains that she relies on NGOs to pay her tuition fees, since finding a job has become almost impossible in Lebanon due to the economic crisis. She says, since last year, I'm unable to pay my tuition fees. Both my parents have lost their jobs, so I have registered with an NGO that is covering my tuition fees and sometimes even provides me with money to get my basic needs. But this is not sustainable. I think that at the end of the day, I will have to leave the country to find a decent job. Last month, the Save the Children charity warned children in Lebanon are skipping many of their meals as parents struggle to afford basic foods. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
2021 saw Lebanon continuing its economic and political spiral, but there is hope among some observers that parliamentary elections in the coming year will bring an opportunity for change. Ordinary Lebanese fed up with the corrupt political elites hope that some independent candidates who are part of the cross-sectarian movement from the October 2019 protests will be viable candidates in parliamentary elections scheduled for March. If some win, analysts wonder whether parliament could be reformed to redirect Lebanon's disastrous course, or is it too much wishful thinking? For VOA, Del Gavlak reports.
Lebanon's parliamentary election will be the first held since the popular uprising in late 2019, when hundreds of thousands took to the streets demanding an end to the entrenched political and economic patronage system, blamed for multiple dire crises engulfing the tiny Mediterranean country. A spiraling economy has plunged three-quarters of Lebanese into poverty, as their local currency has lost some 93% of its value. Medicine and electricity are in short supply, while food prices have skyrocketed due to inflation. The economic meltdown, coinciding with the coronavirus outbreak, has posed the worst threat to Lebanon's stability since the 1975-1990 civil war, observers say. Over the course of 2021, the heavily armed Iran-backed Hezbollah Shiite militia and political party, along with its allies, have repeatedly tried to remove the judge responsible for investigating the deadly 2020 Beirut port explosion, accusing him of political bias, a charge independents deny. Many Lebanese are angry that no senior official has yet been held accountable for the country's worst peacetime disaster. Meanwhile, Gulf Arab states accuse Hezbollah of trying to proliferate drugs into their region via fruit and vegetable imports, straining historic ties with Lebanon. Several activist platforms fielding candidates have formed, analysts say, such as Mentesrin, meaning from October, and coming from different backgrounds, to break down divisions the political elite have fostered, such as voting along sectarian lines. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University told VOA that former lawmaker Nimat Frem, who resigned from parliament to protest patronage, launched the Project Watan, Our Homeland initiative.
It's an attempt to create a forum that would challenge the powers that be at the ballot box in the upcoming parliamentary elections. Whether elections will be anywhere near free and fair, whether there will be serious international monitoring, which is something that is absolutely important, we don't know. But this is one of those last-ditch civil society efforts. And so far, it's received a lot of positive feedback from people who are absolutely desperate for something like this.
Malik said Frem is very committed to winning in the upcoming elections and creating a parliamentary bloc with other allies that will challenge democratically the mafia militia cartel, as it's described by critics, now hijacking Lebanon and holding it hostage. It's a reference to the corrupt political elite and their power broker, Hezbollah, the only militia in Lebanon that has clung to its weapons.
Political analyst Dania Khalia Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut told VOA that primaries are unlikely to be held, but perhaps polls will enable stronger independent candidates to emerge from the so-called October Thawra, or revolution protest movement.
To be eligible, you need to believe and feel like the unity of Lebanon, the exclusivity of arms for the state, fight corruption. People can say, I represent the Thawra. Anyone might get 5 votes, get 10,000 votes or 100,000 votes.
But other observers argue that even if opposition candidates succeed in winning seats, immediate change for needed reforms is not assured as long as Iran continues to have influence in Lebanon's domestic affairs. Still, opponents of Hezbollah say they see the parliamentary elections as a chance to overturn its majority won in 2018 and that of the parties in power which support its possession of weapons. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And in other news, Geneva's chief prosecutor said on Monday that he had closed a criminal investigation into allegations that Spain's former King Juan Carlos laundered illegal commission payments from Saudi Arabia. He dropped the case due to insufficient evidence. Prosecutor Yves Batossa said he had established that Saudi Arabia had paid $100 million in August 2008 into an account opened a month before at Mirabaud Private Bank in the name of a Panamanian foundation whose beneficial owner was Juan Carlos. Batossa said that he had opened the criminal investigation in 2018 following news reports that the former king, who abdicated in 2014, may have received illegal commissions linked to the contracts and stashed the funds in Swiss accounts. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while here, check out our other programs like Straight Talk Africa, Africa 54 TV show, and others. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We are also on YouTube where you can watch our videos. Remember to like, subscribe, and share. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Residents of the Ethiopian town of Lalibela, a UN World Heritage Site, say Tigray rebels have captured the area from federal forces for a second time. Gelmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
Town residents who spoke to Reuters said the rebel force captured Lalibela on Sunday following the exit of Ethiopian troops. The eyewitnesses say that, for no reasons that are known, government soldiers began to leave Lalibela Saturday night and they heard an exchange of fire from a distance. Neither the Ethiopian government nor the Tigray forces have commented on the situation in Lalibela. However, AFP has reported that the TPLF has launched attacks on many towns around Lalibela. TPLF-affiliated media also report an engagement with Ethiopian forces around Gashana area, 59 kilometers from Lalibela. Ethiopian government troops took over Lalibela, home to 11 ancient rock-hewn churches, 2 weeks ago, driving out TPLF forces who had been in control of the town since the beginning of August. The town was freed a week after Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed went into battle to lead the fight against the Tigray rebels. Lalibela Church, a UNESCO-recognized World Heritage Site, is a place of pilgrimage for Ethiopian Orthodox Christians. Recently, government-run outlets reported on preparations to celebrate the upcoming Ethiopian Christmas at the site. Speaking to AFP, residents of the town say the TPLF rebels were tough on residents, but treated the holy site well during their month's stay. The Ethiopian government accuses the TPLF rebels of destroying hospitals and basic infrastructures in areas they occupy. Gelmo Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Villagers in Cameroon's northwest region claim military troops searching for rebels this past week killed at least 13 civilians, including children. Cameroon's military has denied the allegations. And this is not the first time Cameroon's military has been accused of killing civilians in its fight against Anglophone separatists, as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroonian government officials and non-governmental organizations say several dozen civilians have fled Mbengui, a commercial town in the English-speaking northwest region. Roman Catholic Church leaders in Cameroon say several people escaped from villages around Mbengue fled to safer localities, including Bamenda, capital of the English-speaking Northwest region, Bafoussam, a French-speaking western town, and Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. 42-year-old Peter Chefo escaped to Yaoundé Saturday after his home was torched. He accuses Cameroonian troops fighting separatists in Bengue of burning down his home.
When I looked through the window, I saw the military outside roughing my son. At that point, one of the military guys' leg was already on my son's head, so I shouted that he's my son. They should not kill him. He's not an AMBA fighter.
Chefo, his wife and two children now live with his younger brother in Yaoundé. Government officials say civilians are escaping battles between separatists and government troops. Roman Catholic Church officials in Bengue say at least 13 civilians, including children, have been killed and about 20 houses torched in Bengue over the past week. Bengue residents and rights groups say several youths have been arrested and their whereabouts remain unknown. Rights groups have strongly criticized the arrests, the killings of civilians, including children and women, the burning of houses, the destruction of property, and looting. The Cameroon military has denied that its troops are committing atrocities in Bengue. Eyong Ta is an official of the Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa, CHRDA. He says Cameroon's government should investigate and punish troops for what he calls retaliatory attacks on civilians accused of collaborating with separatist fighters. Ta accuses the military of human rights violations as it fights separatists.
After eyewitnesses' testimony, video evidence, and satellite imagery, the Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa, in collaboration with the Cameroon Anglophone Crisis Database of Atrocities, confidently attest or confirm that the burning of homes was caused by the defense forces, and there is no way that can be refused or denied.
Ta said it is unfortunate that civilians accused of collaborating with separatist fighters are either killed or have their houses torched by the military, while people accused of collaborating with the military are either killed or their houses torched by separatist fighters. Ayabacho Lucas is commander of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, ADF, a group that says it fights for the independence of the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. He refers to the state he and others hope to create as Ambazonia and denies that separatist fighters are committing atrocities. He sends a message to the Cameroonian army and says separatists will fight until government troops leave the English-speaking western regions.
Ambazonia is our land, our hope, is our place of respite. You think if you burn our homes, you molest our children, they will give up. Make no mistake. We will turn the ammo cars into dust. We will fight till the end.
Both the Cameroon military and separatist fighters accuse each other of attacking civilians. Army spokesman Captain Cyril Serge Atongfak Ngemo, in a statement Monday, said the military, on a reconnaissance mission, was hit by an improvised explosive device. Atongfak said the military deployed troops to fight separatists on the road linking Bengue and Bamenda, both English-speaking northwestern towns. Military officials say the army lost one tactical vehicle in the battle. Government troops say four separatist fighters were killed, but separatists say none of their fighters died. The separatists claim that at least seven government troops were killed last week when fighters destroyed a military armored car in Bengue. Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to form an English-speaking state within the majority French-speaking country. UN officials say the conflict has killed more than 3,300 people and displaced more than 500,000. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. And visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi wishing you a good day ahead.